May be seated. Ms. Shell.
Good morning. May it please the court. Alan McNeil was denied his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. After being charged with three felonies, he was appointed an attorney, but her representation of him was plagued by inaction. Most importantly, she failed to file a meritorious motion to suppress, which, if granted, would have resulted in suppression of all of the evidence and dismissal of the charges. Because of this...
I'm sorry, counsel, just so I understand your argument on that, is it your position that we can make that judgment now or that there has to be a hearing before the district court on that question?
Our position is that this court can make the judgment on ineffective assistance now based on the record that we have.
We don't know... don't we have to get some information about what the lawyer knew at the time, how much information had been conveyed to her, and then also whether she had some strategic reason for not bringing the motion?
Our position is that there is no conceivable strategic reason under the circumstances of this case.
Well, suppose the prosecutor thought that Mr. McNeil had committed a murder, but they didn't quite have the strongest case, but they were willing to charge him unless he pleaded guilty to this. Wouldn't that be a good reason?
We just have no indication that anything like that was happening in this case.
Well, that's the problem with giving with granting ineffective assistance now, because unlike in Gruninger and the Primo case, we don't have a record.
So let me explain. This is our primary position. We do raise an alternative request that if this court were not to just hold that Mr. McNeil's counsel was ineffective based on this record, that we would be requesting then a remand for a hearing on that issue. But the reason why this record is different than some other cases where we do need a hearing on ineffectiveness is because we have the police reports and the warrant affidavit, the exact documents that Mr. McNeil's attorney had when she was making the decision of whether or not there was a viable suppression issue in this case.
If that's the case, because the police reports don't say that the two people, the two children who answered the door, said that their father wasn't home. That's not in the police reports, and it seems like you rely on that very heavily for your Fourth Amendment argument. So we don't know. Did the lawyer at the time, did your client tell his lawyer, oh, my two kids said I wasn't home? Like, how much information did she have when, if all she had was the police report, she doesn't really have much.
The police reports say that the children were inside by themselves.
What if they said, my dad's in the backyard?
Which is, our position is that that is an implication that Mr. McNeil is not in the house. The police reports do not say anything about Mr. McNeil being present anywhere else on the property or any indication. So based on that record, which is what Mr. McNeil's counsel had before trial, it should have been clear to her that there was a meritorious suppression issue based on those police reports and the warrant affidavits. Those documents reveal that the police conducted an illegal search when they entered Mr. McNeil's backyard without probable cause or a warrant and without any other justification for being there. This was an illegal fishing expedition. There is no justification for the officer's conduct. They did not have a warrant, which would be required to search Mr. McNeil's curtilage. And without a warrant, they were limited to acting as any member of the public might act. They could approach Mr. McNeil's front door, they could knock, and they could try to speak to whomever answered. But after learning that he was not home, they had to leave, just like a member of the public would do. But instead, they walked around his house, through his curtilage, into his backyard, and up to the shed in the back, where they ultimately collected all of the evidence against him. So our position is that the merits of this motion are clear and should have been obvious to Mr. McNeil's attorney as soon as she received those documents in discovery. And under the circumstances of this particular case, where there's no plea offer, there was no plea agreement, there could not have been strategic reasons for counsel not to file this motion. Mr. McNeil's attorney had him plead guilty to the entire indictment, all of the charges, with no plea agreement and no limit on his sentencing exposure. He received no meaningful benefit for this plea. All he got was a 1-point reduction in the recommended sentencing range for the early plea, but this didn't even guarantee a shorter sentence.
Can I ask you a question about the plea-related ineffective assistance claims?
Sure.
Are you making an argument now that trial counsel was ineffective for permitting Mr. McNeil to plead guilty without an agreement?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, because it seems like that was an argument in front of the district court, but you're no longer raising it.
No, and I apologize if that was unclear.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes, no. Just in the context of looking at the Fourth Amendment claim, and that on the one hand, we have a very strong motion that, if granted, would have resulted in dismissal. And on the other hand, there's no benefit to Mr. McNeil's plea in this case, because he didn't even have a plea agreement. He pled guilty to the entire indictment.
Counsel might have been trying to negotiate a plea.
We don't have any indication of that. And Mr. McNeil alleges in his petition that he asked her to negotiate to speak with government, and she didn't.
On the plea point, what exactly are the claims you are raising now, as I understand it, not that it was ineffective to allow the defendant to plead guilty with no upside, but rather a failure to negotiate a plea, and also maybe a failure to transmit a plea offer?
So the claims in our first set of briefing, which is what I have focused my arguments on today thus far, are ineffective assistance for failing to file a motion to suppress.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but so are you not raising any other? I'm just
yes,
putting and to then, one side the motion to suppress. What sure, else are you raising?
Sure. So the issues that are raised in our supplemental briefing, which was on the second grant of a COA, there are two claims there. One is ineffectiveness for failing to negotiate with the government or potentially communicate a plea offer if one was made. That's one claim, but it kind of has two parts to it, because on the one hand, there is Mr. McNeil asking his attorney to negotiate, and he alleges that she did not. On the other hand, if a plea offer was made, one was not communicated. That's one claim raised in the supplemental briefing. And then the second claim in the supplemental briefing was a failure to investigate.
I will stop in a minute, but on the one claim related to the plea, the claim is, the law treats those two things quite differently, failure to transmit a plea offer versus failure to negotiate. And so I'm just trying to get my hands around sort of what is the claim.
Yeah, so Mr. McNeil alleged both, and again, this is in our supplemental briefing. He alleged that his attorney, that he asked her to speak with the prosecutor and she did not do so. So she did not try to get a plea bargain for him on the one hand. On the other hand, he also alleges, and this is, I believe, undisputed, that no plea offer was communicated to Mr. McNeil. Under the circumstances of this case, it is likely that an offer was made, as they often are, and it was not communicated. So those are the two parts.
But they sound alternative, right? They can't both be right.
Well, I think the common theme here is inaction. Mr. McNeil's attorney just failed to act on his behalf. So she didn't affirmatively try to negotiate, and she also wasn't communicating with him. And so if an offer was made to her, even if she didn't initiate the negotiations, you know, she didn't communicate that to him. Turning back to...
Can I just ask you a question on the ineffective assistance issue? You contend that the Gruninger test applies here, but that has been applied primarily in cases where the case goes to trial, not on pleas. And the Primo rule, one could argue, applies to a plea case. How do you distinguish... Why should we not apply the Primo rule?
Primo, Gruninger, Presley, these are all the Strickland standard. They are just applications of the Strickland standard to different circumstances.
Right.
The Presley-Gruninger analysis that this court has applied fits this case because that is designed for scenarios where counsel was ineffective for failing to file a motion to suppress, which is the primary allegation here. In this court's decisions, in Presley, in Gruninger, there was nothing about that analysis that depended on the defendant having gone to trial instead of taking a plea. It is a specific application of the Strickland standard that fits this scenario. So we are asking this court to apply the Strickland standard, and specifically to look to Presley for the first three elements, which are under deficient performance, whether the motion had some substance, and then if so, whether there were any strategic reasons for not raising it. And under the prejudice prong, to ask whether the motion was meritorious and likely would have been granted. And then the final piece of the prejudice analysis is the only part that can't come directly from Presley because that was a trial case. And that's the part of the analysis where we ask whether, but for the ineffectiveness, there's a reasonable probability that the defendant wouldn't have, in Presley, would not have been convicted. Here, we're asking this court to apply the guilty plea analysis, the Strickland analysis set forth in Hill, cases applying Hill, reasonable probability that Mr. McNeil would not have pled guilty to the entire indictment. And on that point of prejudice, Mr. McNeil was prejudiced by his counsel's inaction because, as I mentioned, if the suppression motion had been litigated successfully, the charges would have been dismissed. All of the evidence against Mr. McNeil was gathered from that shed in the backyard, which means it was fruit of the officer's illegal entry into his cartilage without a warrant.
Can I ask you a question? I'm back over on the plea-related claims of ineffective assistance. So I think you argue that the district court, to the extent the district court was applying a waiver analysis, and it actually looks to me like he was only applying the waiver analysis to the claim you are not raising here, the ineffective by virtue of allowing Mr. McNeil to plead guilty with no agreement. But to the extent the district court is applying a waiver analysis at all, you say the district court got it wrong because the district court thought these were sworn statements under oath, and in fact they were not sworn statements. And I guess my question is, how much does that matter?
Well, our position is there is just no conflict here between any sworn statements that Mr. McNeil made and any of the ineffective assistance claims that we are raising.
Right, but if Mr. McNeil just said in court, but not under oath, I am satisfied with my counsel's performance, that would not, why would that not also be something we would look into in terms of whether this claim has been waived?
I don't believe this court has ever held that an unsworn statement that conflicts with an allegation of ineffectiveness would would meet that same standard.
I also couldn't find any case where we said it wouldn't. And so I guess I'm just asking you, as a common sense matter, why does it matter so much if he was under oath at that precise moment?
Sure, because the statement under oath carries significantly more weight. The threat of perjury, for example. So our position is that wouldn't count, but also that in this case, we don't even have that. All we have is Mr. McNeil's silence in response to, a judge asking a group of people a series of questions with the preface, if anyone would like to answer, please raise your hand. It's very different from a one-on-one plea colloquy under oath where a person is being asked specific questions and making specific answers.
How many people were in that group?
I don't know, Your Honor. It's not reflected in the transcript. Okay. Unless the court has additional questions, I will reserve my rebuttal time.
Thank you, Ms. Schell.
Thank you.
Mr. Casper.
May it please the court, Andrew Casper on behalf of the United States. I would like to start with the standard of review for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim related to the failure to file a motion to suppress. With respect to my colleague, we do believe there is a material difference between the Primo standard, which was applied in the context of a guilty plea as opposed to a case that proceeded to trial, and the standard from Grudinger and Presley. The Primo standard is for the deficient performance prong is a no competent attorney standard. By contrast, the Grudinger standard is a standard that looks at whether the motion would have had some substance, which is, we believe, a materially different standard than no competent attorney, and then also whether there were reasonable strategic reasons for the counsel not to file the motion.
Ms. Chess, would you keep your voice up a little? You're trailing off a bit. Thank you.
I apologize. The microphone is falling down. So turning first to the some substance standard versus the no competent attorney standard.
Can I ask you a question just before? I understand the point you're making, but it does seem like I'm not sure bifurcating the two steps makes that much sense, because under Grudinger and Presley, you're also going to have to show this motion would have been granted. So maybe that's really the difference, no competent attorney versus meritorious would have been granted.
Yes, so I would say one important point is that both the McMahon case, which we cite, and Kimmelman, which is a later case that Primo relies on, both say whether or not the motion would have been granted is not the determinative consideration for whether a counsel provided ineffective assistance for not filing a motion to suppress.
All right, because sometimes there are strategic reasons and... Yeah.
So there's strategic reasons, and that's one reason. And I think, and we can talk about this, I'm happy to discuss it, there are many strategic reasons that one can conceive of from the record before this court, which I agree is not complete as to the counsel's reasoning. However, there are also, and Justice White points this out in his opinion in McMahon, there is uncertainty as to how motions will be ruled on, even if there's a correct apprehension of what the law is. So, in this way,
we have to assume that the court would follow the law, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
But so if you look at, and I don't want to confuse Grudinger with Presley, but one of them involved a Miranda issue where it was whether the defendant invoked his right to counsel under Miranda.
That's Grudinger.
And he said, I need counsel. And there was very clear, sort of explicit precedent from Mosley, which said that is sufficient to invoke the right to counsel. It's kind of black letter law. And I'd compare that to the Scott case from the 11th Circuit, which we cite in our brief, which is it's a Terry stop case. And it's a reasonable suspicion issue where there's a totality of a circumstances analysis. And in that context, you can understand the underlying law that Terry requires the court to engage in, but looking at all the facts and how those will ultimately be adjudicated by a court, attorney could have a reasonable but incorrect analysis of what it ultimately will be here. And we would argue that in this context, whether, they had authority to go beyond the front door when they were doing the search is more in that universe of uncertain legal questions that they could under, she, you know, counsel could have understood the applicable law, but still not determined how a court would ultimately adjudicate it.
So I just want to make sure I understand the standard of review issue. So Gruninger and Presley come after Primo. So, you know, we have to follow Gruninger and Presley. And so your argument as well, but those were cases where people went to trial versus pleading guilty. And for the life of me, I cannot see why that would be a relevant difference when what you're considering is the deficient performance prong. The question is, did the attorney provide deficient, fall below reasonable professional standards? Was the performance deficient when the lawyer didn't file a motion to suppress? And that happens before there's either a trial or a plea agreement. So if we were talking about prejudice, I could see why, I mean, even your colleague recognized you have to make some tweaks to the standard. But why would the deficiency question, which occurs like before probably you even know whether there's going to be a plea or a trial, why would that turn on what happens next?
Because there is a universe, there's greater uncertainty. If you look at the Primo opinion itself, and this is on page 132 of the opinion, it says that there are certain differences between inadequate assistance of counsel claims in cases where there was a full trial on the merits and those like this one where a plea was entered. And the reasons include, one, if a defendant pleads guilty early, as was the case here, and I would note, the defendant just said he was allowed to plead guilty. He does not make any allegation about the specific advice provided to his counsel. It is, from our reading, consistent with his pleading to say counsel could have advised him not to plead guilty. But he may have chosen to plead guilty because he wanted to, you know, convey to the community that he was not cooperating with the government. He might have wanted to forestall further investigation about issues his counsel were not aware of. And those are reasons that are consistent with pleading guilty and, you know, his counsel providing effective assistance that are still apparent from the record.
Did you say a little while ago that we can infer from things that are in the record in this case what counsel's strategy was in this case?
We can infer what the counsel's actual strategy was, but I think we can discern reasons why it would have been appropriate to advise an attorney.
Tell me what that is, where it says that in the record.
So for example, the defendant was the indictment only alleged 1 month of conduct related to drug dealing. If you read the his statement that was given to the law enforcement officer as recorded in that statement, he had been dealing drugs for an unclear period of time, and further investigation by the government. Say they have a suppression motion hearing and his children are asked to testify and they're asked, you know, how long has your dad been, you know, dealing drugs from this backyard building? That could have opened him up to greater liability. There could have been other factual reasons. Appearing before this judge, they might not have wanted the full universe of facts related to his misconduct to be in front of the judge that was ultimately going to handle his sentencing, when it would be instead a limited universe of facts in the PSR.
Is there anything in the record from which we can infer either of those theories?
Well, as I said, one, we have his own Mirandi statement, or his Mirandi statement as to the nature of his conduct. So you could.
What about the second thing, that he's afraid of getting his kids to testify and so forth?
We don't know. I will say there are cases, and I think Scott is one of these cases, right, where courts have recognized that that is a reason to choose to plead guilty early.
As the judge once said to me, you can find anything in an F-sub opinion if you look far enough.
And that is also why I would say that, you know, we believe that there was a sufficient basis for the court to dismiss this petition, without having any evidentiary development. And I would also note that he did not ask for evidentiary development related to the suppression issue. But also, while we think that at a minimum this court, if it is inclined to reverse the dismissal, it should be remanded to the district court for factual development.
Counsel, I think sort of whatever standard we're operating under, like the main question, right, is would this have been a meritorious motion, and just exactly how meritorious it has to be. Let's put that to one side for a minute. So Is it your position that on the record as it now stands and accepting the truth of Mr. McNeil's sworn allegation that his children said he wasn't home and then the police just went into the backyard anyway to poke around and see if they could find him, that's a frivolous Fourth Amendment claim? That's what the district court thought.
So first of all, I just do want to say, and I understand your question, that we do not agree that the issue before this court rises and falls with whether it was a meritorious motion. But, and I can have to talk about that further, but I do want to answer the question you ultimately asked.
We probably all agree that if it's a frivolous motion, that if the district court was right, then there's no ineffective assistance claim. So why don't we approach it that way?
Okay, and so I would also say that we don't believe that it has to be frivolous for...
I'm just asking for the government's position. Does the government agree with the district court that this would have been a frivolous motion to suppress?
The government does not believe it would have been frivolous, no. However, the government also believes that there could be reasonable strategic reasons why it was not filed. The government also believes that a competent attorney could have believed that a motion would have failed.
So I feel like a competent attorney would have said there's clear precedent in the Fourth Circuit under Covey and cases like that, that the police can bypass the front door altogether if there's some reason to believe. Skip the front door because the guy is over in the driveway. That's one of our cases. Or there's a big sign that says we're around back. That's another case. But short of that, it does not say you can try the front door first, and then if you're told that the person isn't home, feel free, if you've still got questions, to enter the curtilage, invade this person's privacy, and see maybe if you can find him in the backyard. I can't find any support for that.
So I think... we agree with you that the standard is there has to be reason to believe that you are going to find the primary occupant.
I feel like there's two levels of questions here. Because I can't find anything that says you can try the door first, and if you're not lucky at the door, then we'll talk about reason to believe. I don't feel like you get two bites of the apple under our precedent. Our precedent says you can skip the front door, not you can go to the front door, get told someone's not home, and then we'll talk about reason to believe.
So I'm trying to look at my notes about our Fourth Circuit cases versus other circuits cases, because I do recall cases from other circuits where...
Yes, other circuits, I agree. But I think we would do the analysis of the merits of the hypothetical suppression motion under Fourth Circuit law.
I would agree, though I also don't know that the Fourth Circuit has said that, it's foreclosed that somebody could answer the door, because you could envision a situation where somebody answers the door and says, this person's not in the house, but there's also very other clear evidence that that person is somewhere else on the property.
And why did you go to the front door?
It's a good step for law enforcement to first approach the front door.
I feel like the whole point of this, I'll let this go in a minute, but the whole point of Jardines, I don't know how to pronounce it, is that we treat the police officer like any ordinary social visitor. And I sort of feel like if a social visitor comes to my house and my kids answer the door and say she's not home, I would be really surprised if that person then went around into the backyard to look for me.
Well, I think that in this context, there was reason for the officers to believe that an adult was at the home. And we point this out, is that, you know, it didn't have to just be the defendant. It could have been the defendant's wife was home. And so they could say, well, the defendant is not home, but they could still believe that an adult is there. We have facts in the record which would have led a reasonable officer to believe that an adult was home.
Why? I mean, I'm sorry, what facts?
So I would say first, there was, within 30 minutes of knocking on the front door, there was a stop of a traffic stop that occurred that, and the officer said was indicative, that provided information that was indicative of a drug transaction occurring at the house. They had seen somebody coming from, going to the house at that time and then leaving, and then they had...
They didn't even see what happened at the front door, right? For all we know, the two kids answered the door and said, yeah, he's not home.
Yeah, but we also know that in his PSR, petitioner did not dispute. He accepted all aspects of the PSR that the marijuana had just been purchased at the home. And if that marijuana was purchased at the home, presumably it was from an adult.
You mean he didn't object to it?
He did not object to it, no. But he was given an opportunity expressly to object to the PSR and did not object to it. And also, there was in the police report from Mr. Robinson on page 119 of the JA, the officer who went and knocked on the door had been advised that the traffic stop had been conducted and that marijuana had been purchased at the residence. So they believed that, which would give them reason to believe that there was an adult there. Additionally, there were juveniles found in the home. We don't know how old the ones were that answered the door. We know of three kids from the PSR. One is ages 14 to 15.
But Mr. Jasper, all those things you're talking about, it doesn't extend the police officer's right to do a knock and inquire. You're just saying, well, there are other reasons that, no, it still is the same thing. You don't have a warrant. You can have all kinds of suspicion. But if that's all you're going on, then you have to say, hello, you're here, I'd like to talk to you. And they stay in the house and say, or say through the door, I'm here, but I do not want to speak to you. What do you think the police officer have to do then? All the suspicions you talked about, what does the police officer have to do then?
I think that when it is children who answer the door, it is a reasonable for them to try to find the adult occupant of the home.
Why? Why do they have to find out about it? That's their home, and they said, not here. End of story. It's not an interrogation. It's a knock and inquire. You know, like, I want to speak to somebody. They said they're not here. They have to leave, don't they? Don't they have to leave by our jurisprudence?
I don't think our jurisprudence has dealt with this particular factual scenario where...
How long did it get to stay? For 2 hours? 5? 12? How many hours?
And I would say this is a thing that separates this from other cases. In one of the cases from our circuit, in addition to sort of going to a building in the back, they did searches in between where they looked between fences. It was at night, et cetera. Here, there's no evidence in the record that they did anything but go to another building in the property and knock on the door of that building. And that building also had exterior, what appears to be exterior things which indicated this was a living space or space used by people, which is there's an air conditioning unit, there's sort of surveillance cameras.
I thought the police report said they called it a shed, no?
But there's also in the... The defendant said during his Mirandized interview that there was electricity to it. The PSR, which again the defendant accepted, described it as a...
Police don't say they saw any of that. They don't. The police reports do not say we thought that was an apartment. Right? They say they thought it was a shed.
Yes, but I think the important point on this is that if there had been a suppression hearing, all of this additional evidence that might have come into play after the fact, which the police report don't necessarily recite everything, but they could have testified at that hearing. That evidence could have come forward in a suppression hearing.
Do you think there's a dispute of fact about what the children said at the front door?
I think we don't. All we know from the police officer's reports is that no one was there. No one was there. We don't know what they actually said. Saying. Yeah, okay. And that's how we read the trend. Okay.
Can you tell me how this Rule 11 colloquy worked down there? They line them all up and ask them as a group a bunch of questions?
Yes, so the way the colloquy worked in this case, and it's not always exactly the same way, but the way it worked in this case, and it does happen in other cases as well, is they have several defendants that are brought in, and there's a certain universe of questions that are asked to the defendants as a group. And then the defendants are sworn and individually asked. In this case, I think there's two important things that he was asked. One, did you understand all of my prior questions? And two, did you answer my prior questions truthfully? And then they also go through a number of inquiries specific to the guilty plea. You know, do you understand the nature of the charges against you? Do you understand you have the right not to plead guilty? Understand the sentencing consequences of what you're doing. So there is a sort of a two-part process. One is a group process, and then one is an individualized process.
On the colloquy and the waiver by colloquy, as I understand your brief, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, your argument for why there should not be an evidentiary hearing on the claim that the that counsel sort of refused to negotiate a plea agreement is that that was waived, not exactly under oath, but it's like kind of the transitive property. When he says under oath, I understood your questions and I answered properly, that was a waiver of that claim.
Yes.
Okay, can I just, two follow-up questions. One is, why then, in your view, didn't it waive the Fourth Amendment suppression motion and effective assistance claim? I don't understand.
So we did argue that as well.
You argued that the Fourth Amendment suppression motion is waived also.
Yeah, so we had in a portion of our brief related to the Fourth Amendment, I think the last paragraph of our section cites to Lemaster.
All waived. Okay. And then my other question is, as I read the district court's opinion, the district court thinks that what was waived was an allegation that the lawyer was ineffective in allowing Mr. McNeil to plead guilty without a plea agreement. That's what the district court says was waived. And putting to one side this whole sworn versus unsworn thing, like, I can see why that makes sense. Like, you know that at the time you're standing up there, you're taking a plea without an agreement. So if at that moment you don't think your counsel did anything wrong, I get that. But that's not what the district court says about the failure to negotiate a plea. And that seems to me it would be sort of different because you might get information about that after the colloquy.
My time has expired. May I answer your question?
Yes, you may.
And I think one really important point in the actual 2255 itself and his in his supporting memorandum is that he doesn't actually allege anything related to any of his issues that he has learned since he pled guilty that is new. And that's an important distinction, I think, with Paylor and with other cases, is that all the information that he has alleged, from what we can tell on the record before us, is something that he would have known before he pled guilty. And we do believe...
I agree that the record before us is very sparse, but I guess I'm thinking, since we really can't tell, and since the district court didn't rely on that, so you want us to affirm the... no hearing on failure to negotiate a plea for a reason different than the district court gave us and just rely on waiver for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we think there's no reason even for remand for evidentiary hearing for that because his, you know, the sort of factual allegations underlying that, that there was a complete breakdown in attorney-client communications prior to pleading guilty are just contrary to his statements under at his Rule 11 hearing. Which, you know, he was asked a number of different questions which would speak to that issue, and in none of those answers did he give any indication that he was unhappy with his counsel.
Well, but the question was, did you hear me and understand me when I described all the rights you have? Yes. Did you hear and understand all the other questions I asked the defendants as a group? Yes.
Well, and on J.A.
That's what he says.
And Your Honor, on J.A. 53, later on in the colloquy, he was asked whether he answered all of his questions. He answered all of my questions truthfully here today, and he said yes as well.
Well, yeah, but he didn't ever say under oath that the things that he said when they were looking at them as a group, when he was talking to them as a group.
So he did. He was asked a question as a group, and he did not raise his hand when asked that question about his satisfaction with his counsel.
So this whole thing relies on a failure to raise a hand in response to a group question when someone wasn't under oath. That's the waiver.
I think that, and then his other statements where, you know, he was asked during his individualized colloquy about his understanding of the sentencing process. He was, so there was other opportunities.
He never says the words, I am satisfied with my lawyer's performance.
There is no, he is not out of his mouth saying, I'm satisfied with my lawyer's attorney.
Out of anyone's mouth.
Well, we would say that when the judge asked that question, doesn't raise his hand. He's asked whether he understood the prior questions, and then he says he answered truthfully to prior questions. That would be his adoption of that statement. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Casper. Michelle, you have time reserved.
Thank you. 2 points, Your Honors. On the merits of the suppression issue, the law is absolutely clear from the Supreme Court and from this court that the police were limited to sticking within areas where a member of the public would go. And in this case, there was no reason to think that Mr. McNeil or any other adult was home. They did not see what happened at the front door before they got there. And I just want to clarify that the police report does not say that the marijuana that was found on the vehicle passenger was purchased at Mr. McNeil's house. It also does not say when or where it was purchased at all. And the second point, just to touch very briefly back sort of on the initial questions from Your Honors about the need for a hearing on ineffectiveness in this case. Again, our position is that this record is clear enough to show ineffectiveness under the Strickland standard. And there are several recent cases where this court has made that finding itself based on the record, even when there was no hearing at the district court. This was the case in McKinney in 2013, Carthorne in 2017, Gruninger 2016, Mooney in 2007. Those cases are cited in the briefs. But alternatively, of course, we would be requesting a remand for a hearing on the issue of ineffectiveness.
Don't you have, do you have a time situation in this case, to reason to expedite, if, for example, that was the remedy?
Mr. McNeil has served quite a lot of his 9.5-year sentence, and our position is that, but for his attorney's ineffectiveness, he wouldn't have served any of that time. So okay. Time is of the essence.
All right.
Unless the court has any additional questions.
We don't. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll come down, greet counsel, and proceed to our next case.